KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next in this morning's second hour of Forum, famed local novelist Amy Tan joins us to discuss her most recent novel, her fifth. It's called Saving Fish from Drowning. She'll join us for a wide-ranging discussion of her murder mystery, satiric, and political novel, which moves us from San Francisco all the way into the jungles of Burma. She joins us next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum. Famed local novelist Amy Tan joins us for this hour of Forum. Her newest novel, her fifth, is called Saving Fish from Drowning. It concerns Bibi Chen, a millionaire San Francisco socialite and art dealer who is violently and mysteriously killed, but manages to narrate the story of a group of 11 Americans who go on a tour of which he had been the prime mover and disappear into a Burmese jungle after being kidnapped by local tribesmen. Redolent of politics, satire, humor, and farce, as well as tragedy, the story seems a new kind of novel for Amy Tan, the author of seven books, including The Joy Luck Club, The Kitchen God's Wife, The Opposite of Fate, The Bonesetter's Daughter, which is slated to be an opera, and Sagwa, The Chinese Siamese Cat. Her work has been translated into 36 languages, and she joins us for this morning's second hour of Forum. And always good to see you. Welcome.
Yeah.
We were talking a little bit off air about how maybe this is a different turn for you in the sense that you've always written personally. This is personal, too. But it's political because you want to call attention to Burma, to Myanmar. Or let's still call it Burma.
Yeah, however you pronounce it. Yeah. You know, Myanmar. You know, I had a chance to go to Myanmar. Or Burma. I'm going to call it Burma.
Let's call it Burma.
You know, the regime calls it Myanmar. I had a chance to go there, and I heard that one should boycott Burma. Aung San Suu Kyi, the deposed democratic leader who was under house arrest by the military regime, said that one should boycott going there in protest, nonviolent protest. And I had this moral decision to make. I didn't understand that much about Burma. I had to learn a little bit more. Of course, there's always the argument of constructive engagement. So it really became a question, not just about Burma, but anything that you do where there's a moral dilemma. What do you base your decision upon? You know, whether you vote for a political party, how much do you really understand of the situation? And we, of course, can't understand everything. But when you make a moral decision to take action, and yet you don't know what the outcome might be, what would your moral response be if the outcome was actually not what you intended? It happens in so many situations that we see around the world, and not just Burma. Burma just happened to be a wonderful way for me to delve into this on a personal level because I was going there. Decided to go there.
What made you decide, though? I mean, because you were on the fence, obviously. Because
I was on the fence, and especially considering Aung San Suu Kyi and wanting to respect her wishes, did some research that in those last 15 years, nothing much has budged in the way of the regime. But she also said that people might go for understanding. If their purpose of going there was not simply for, admiring the art, that they might go there. And, you know, some people have the argument you should just go there to appreciate what history and art has there. The other reason why I went, the military regime does not allow writers. They do not allow journalists. It's for reasons of censorship. And when somebody says you can't go for those reasons, well, I have to find out why I can't go. I have to go.
So perversity.
Perversity, yes, exactly. Subversiveness, you know. Which, you know, fiction has a great role to play in that kind of unraveling of the truth. Subversive means fiction.
Your idea of fiction, though, somewhat changed here. I mean, in the sense that not only you want to call attention to something political and maybe be subversive, But there's always been this separation, especially in American fiction, between politics and literature. And we were talking a little bit before about writers like Gordimer and Barbara Kingsolver, who say they shouldn't have that separation shouldn't be there, in fact. So you've kind of moved into that camp, or are you still confused about the personal and the political?
Well, I had reservations about that in the beginning. Not to say Barbara Kingsolver and Nadine Gordimer have, you know, done something one shouldn't do. I really ended up believing that it is a personal decision what you do with your fiction, what it means to you. The meaning of your work is very individual. The message of your work is something else that you have to determine as an individual writer. Now, Nadine Gordimer doesn't say that she begins with a political position that she wants to get out in public and then drive that home with the, you know, hammer of fiction. She begins with personal meaning. She wants to explore a curiosity. And these other meanings then come out as a result of that. And of course, you know, having lived in a formerly apartheid country, you know, that certainly was part of her experience.
I like the fact that you keep emphasizing fiction, though, because it's a lie, really. And the irony to me is that this has been bandied about, that this is based on a true story.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't think of it as a lie. Lie seems to have another kind of intention. It is a subterfuge. It is a cooperative suspension of disbelief between the writer and the reader, and for different purposes, either to be entertained, to go to another world, to imagine yourself doing something else, to be entertained. But yes, you can have things like a note to the reader, which people naturally assume is the truth of the story, and the rest is just you know, the fiction. And I played around with that notion in the note to the reader by creating a fiction. And yet there are some very true parts in there. So yes, it is based on the true story of the regime that overthrew the Democratic Party that was legally elected. The untrue parts, or the made-up subterfuge, is that these were automatic writings dictated by a ghost to a medium. I happened to find it concerning 12 tourists who disappeared, made international headlines for weeks. A Chinese socialite maven in San Francisco died mysteriously. That's the fiction.
Now, speaking about headlines, not only are you concerned about drawing attention to Burma, you're also concerned about drawing attention to the way the media tells stories and the way the media presents facts and that sometimes aren't facts at all.
Yeah. Well, first of all, the media can have many different points of view. There's so many different forms of media and also different positions depending on what who you listen to. You know, your point of view is quite different from, you know, say, you know, Fox Radio or something.
No.
Very huge differences in what the version of the truth is that's presented. And I think the media has a huge role to play in informing people and getting their understanding. And then the listener and the reader has a huge responsibility in getting better understanding and taking into consideration these sources of truth. But I've heard in recent years, I think it was in the last 8 years, this phrase used by one network, and I don't even remember the network, but they said, we make the news happen. And it was kind of chilling. I thought it's both true and good. You know, say they call attention to a person who's missing or, you know, something, some devastation like the tsunami, and they get people to donate money. But what about those stories that aren't covered that equally are equally dire? Or what if their coverage of something actually turns out not to be good or raises some ethical questions on how you, quote, make the news happen? So that I wanted to explore that. There's an absolutely good side to the media, an important and necessary side. And there is another complex side that, you know, we also need to think about.
It's an exploitative side, a sensational side,
you know,
and a side that doesn't give you the facts necessarily either. I mean, when B.B. Chen, your main character, dies, we learn I mean, her disdain really hit the way that her obituary reads. There isn't, I mean, the calling her a retailer rather than talking about
chinoiserie instead of, you know, wonderful rare Chinese antiques.
Yeah, she didn't like the chinoiserie. I mean, yeah. And it's a loathsome word to her to use chinoiserie. I mean, that kind of attitude toward just the facts in terms of a person's life and what their life represented, it seems to me.
Yeah, and that's a version of the truth. She was, you know, in retail. She was, you know, what. Dealing in what some people would call chinoiserie. It wasn't lies, but it's a version of the facts, you know, and that's I think what I was playing around with.
Well, you're playing around also with, I mean, to have a dead narrator tell a story to begin with. Now, I think we've actually talked before about your interest in Spiritus Mundi and all that sort of thing. it's come
like
up in our
word.
Conversations before. But there's a sense, I mean, you know, people are saying, is this like Desperate Housewives? I mean, there's a sense of taking a chance, obviously, with having this woman who doesn't really understand exactly how she died, who, you know, hasn't entirely figured everything out as far as her own death, but yet reaches out to us and talks about the breaths that she takes and gives us a sense of some kind of Dantean underworld that she's moving upward. And she's there as a spirit. She's a presence.
She doesn't know which way she's going to move in the world. And by the way, I haven't ever seen Desperate Housewives, so I don't know what the reference is there.
So dead woman tells the story.
Oh, really? Yeah. Okay. Well, dead narrators are wonderful because they have omniscience to some degree. And with the B.B. Chen kind of dead narrator, you have also a personality, an opinionated omniscience, you know, which maybe you wouldn't get in other forms of omniscience, third-person omniscience. And it's that opinionated aspect of omniscience that interested me. Also, I wanted it to be this automatic writing so that it seemed like it had a basis why it would start off with this.
But you get it both ways. She says, I'm human, still human even though I'm dead.
Yeah, you know, that I can suffer these things or I can do things that still have consequences. She doesn't know everything. She doesn't even know what differences in her abilities are there in sensing and feeling and causality issues. But, you know, the use of the dead narrator also has its things to contend with. I couldn't have her know everything, otherwise there's no story. She has to have some reason to keep telling the story and going on, so she knows certain things.
She has to have a stake, in other words.
Yeah, she has to have a reason for learning what happens. But she also has this need to tell the story because she starts off saying, it was not my fault. You know, she has been unfairly maligned through association, her death, and then later on the disappearance of the tourists. And people say, gosh, isn't that strange? And she feels that they've tried to link the two horrific situations together.
I'm curious about B.B. I mean, you give her such a kind of... you give her a biography. You give her a Shanghai pedigree. You talk about Sweet Ma, this rather strange stepmother of hers, evil type of stepmother, almost one might say easily, though complicated in many other ways, and take her through all of this social art world and so forth. In other words, you know, it's almost as if you had a profile, a very full profile. But did that come to you in the writing?
Yeah.
Came to you in the writing?
I didn't have a profile. I borrowed certainly some of the art expertise from various sources and probably distorted it and made a lot of it inaccurate.
A lot of it was very
good.
I beg
their forgiveness. among the people was Bill Wu, Dr. Bill Wu, who is, you know, the person who knows so much about art, Chinese art, and its influence on art in other places and the influence of other art on Chinese sensibilities. He was our tour leader, and he had a wonderful way of looking at the world there. I also borrowed from a guy named Mike Hearn, who's a curator at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, who would take me through and also talk about influences. So there were a number of things that gave me notions about that, in addition to the Asian Art Museum. Asking for forgiveness from some of those people that... And I took their docent tour on a kind of a bummer of a trip.
But you give Bibi a love life. You give her a $20 million legacy that she leaves, in fact, largely to the Asian Art Museum, love of art that's abiding and so forth. In other words, I found myself wondering how much of this figure and this character is created as you're telling the story and how much of it is laid out kind of in a blueprint beforehand.
Some of it, the voice of Bibi, I had to decide ahead of time because that would determine the kind of story she would take. And if I didn't really know everything, that I'd get halfway and say, no, this is her voice. I have to go back and redo everything, perhaps in the entire story. The voice derives a lot from my mother, actually. My mother was very opinionated. She died in 1999. It was very sad that I didn't have her there, but also as the humorous, inadvertent source of stories are us also very difficult.
Forgive me, but your mother was not buried in a eunuch's coffin.
No. No.
Details like that.
I know. It's fun to imagine things like that. You know, things happen in the world for many different reasons. My mother was the sort of person who believed in all kinds of possibilities. So you had fate, you had curses, you had inheritance of legacies, you had God's faith, miracles, modern technology. All of this came into play and collided and made me very confused as I was growing up, but now is a wonderful source of thinking about fictional elements in a story. In this story, Bibi has a lot of this as well, and everything collides. Her inadvertent remark that she would like to, one day, if she should die sooner than later, she would love to be buried in this magnificent coffin carved with all kinds of sprites on it, with a lid up so all could admire the interior artistry. That little casual remark then is something that people follow as her last wish.
A witticism is what she describes it as.
A witticism. And we all do that. I mean, I could say something on air here and, you know, something can happen later and say, oh, remember she said that. And I might have said it as a joke, but, you know, people would perhaps follow it.
It's funny, all that opinionated, and certainly I know enough about your mother to know that she was a woman of strong opinions, to put it mildly, comes across in the character at the same time that she's sort of enjoying almost on some level. They fuss, the De Young and 800 people showing up and for the funeral. It's kind of a fantasy out of Huckleberry Finn, you know, watching your own funeral.
Yeah.
But very critical, I mean, because they put her in a scarf and she feels she looks like a turkey being...
Yeah, and her face makeup is wrong and they combed her hair and this, based on a picture that a friend gave and said, this is what Bibi looked like in the best of times, and she'd been sweating while trekking in the Himalayas and her hair was plastered down and that's the way they did their hair. And, you know, it's sort of this ghoulish, humorous way of looking at one's funeral. So I had fun with that.
You did indeed.
The international aspects, though, I did derive from people I know who came from China and were all over the world and then arrived at their way of looking at the world because of that motley of cultures.
Now, when you were in Burma, did you meet any Karen tribesmen or any?
I met, just casually would meet Karen people, but you really should not, for the safety of those people, talk about politics. I would say something to people about Aung San Suu Kyi, and they kind of indicated to me that they were really not supposed to even say the name. They would refer to her as the lady, and they said, the lady... We respect her views. She's entitled to have them, but we, So they were very cautious in what they said because I think they had the sense they never knew where these words were going to go.
Or who was listening.
Yeah. There were a few opinionated people who would just say outright what they really believed about the regime and had been continuing to do so, and you just had a feeling of fear for what they were saying, and they acknowledged it, you know, that they could be hauled off to jail and tortured and killed. But by and large, no, your average person on the street, I think in any country, the people who have lesser means and lesser education, they're not going to say anything. They just don't want things to get stirred up and for violence to break out as a result of their protests.
I'm not going to give away the plot here, heaven forfend, but there is a belief that the tribe has that is fulfilled by one of the members of the group that goes on the tour that Bibi was supposed to lead. And did this have any roots in any real theology?
It does. Yeah. The Karen tribe actually does. They do have this myth called the Younger White Brother, that in the past in their history, there were these important writings. And because the Karen do not have, you know, a formalized writing system. And that these important writings were lost by two other brothers, left out in a cornfield or something. And the younger white brother, now why is white? I don't know. But the younger white brother would one day come back with the important writers and they would become strong again. Whether or not all of the Karen tribe believes that, I doubt it, you know, but a certain percentage of them do, as well as a certain percentage of them being converted to Christianity, about 20% of them. And almost everybody, no matter what their religion, Buddhist or Baptist, believe in animist notions having to do with gnats, N-A-T-S, which are spirits of people who died in disturbing ways.
They're like poltergeists, usually. Sort of, aren't they?
They're actually things that can live in trees. They're not, you know, they wouldn't take necessarily human form. So they're more animistic in that they can do things in nature and also cause... Yeah, some mischief, like poltergeist in a way. You know, so it was this myth that also led me to believe that maybe some of the Karen believe that the missionaries, with their important writing being the Bible, was, in fact, the younger white brother. And I came across a reference, who knows how accurate it was, of somebody who was less than honorable who came posing as the younger white brother. So I decided to have fun with that. And Buddhism believing that much of life is an illusion, if not all of it, believing you should cast off illusions, I decided to make this character an illusionist, a person who does magic tricks.
Talking to Amy Tan, her new book is Saving Fish from Drowning. Might talk a bit about that title. It's a wonderful story about the fisherman and where it comes from.
Yeah, the true reference to that line came from something I read in a tour guide. And it said that, you know, Burma is a Buddhist country, and so you're not supposed to kill anything. So that in some Buddhist countries, you remain a vegetarian. In others, well, you have to eat, and sometimes they hire the murderer, as they do in Bhutan, or you can eat things that other countries have brought in, or you can have a different intention when you take these foods. Some of the fishermen claim they are taking fish out of the water to save them from drowning, and unfortunately, they aren't saved. They die, and you shouldn't waste anything, so people, you know, they sell them, and people eat them. And
they save them until they expire, in other words.
They save them until they die. You know, there's sort of a necessity involved there. You know, it's justifiable on that level. You could have the best of intentions of saying, I'm sorry I have to do this to you. Or you could have intentions of, well, I got to do this, you know, because I just got to make a living. Or you can say, they're scared.
It's another moral choice, like you were talking about.
Karmic debt, yes. Yeah. Moral choice, moral intention, moral beliefs.
Well, all that in the new novel and more. And in fact, we're going to continue talking to Amy Tan. An opportunity for you to join us now. If you'd like to, by all means do. You can join us toll free, 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls if you'd like to talk to Amy Tan about her new novel or whatever you'd like to talk about. Again, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786 to join us live, or you can email us. And our email address here is forum@kqed.org. And Amy and I co-host every year the Authors Luncheon for the National Kidney Foundation Luncheon. We'll tell you more about how you can actually participate. There's some tickets left, and we'll tell you where she's going to be because she's going to be appearing locally. Join us by phone, though, 866-733-6786. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking to Amy Tan. I'm Michael Krasny, and her new book is called Saving Fish from Drowning. She'll be at Book Passage in Corte Madera tonight at 7 o'clock at the Asian Art Museum. A fundraiser in conversation with Dr. Billy Wu, who she mentioned before, November 3rd, that 6 o'clock reception and 7 o'clock program. More information on their website, www.asianart.org. And I want to plug the Kidney Foundation luncheon because, as Amy was saying, as we were both saying off air, it is quite a lineup this year. They've got the annual luncheon. It's kind of a preeminent literary event that we co-host. And the authors this year include Michael Connelly, Anita DeMont, Tracy Kidder, Dava Sobel, Amy, and Mike Wallace.
Yeah. Incredible.
Quite a lineup indeed. There are still tickets, unbelievably enough. It's at the San Francisco Marriott, Saturday, November 5th. And if you want more information, you can just call the local number here, which is 415-543-3303. That's 415-543-3303. Or go to their website, which is www.kidneynca.org. And we made a moral decision last year. I've never made this public, but when we decided we didn't want the picket lines to be crossed at the hotel, and
yeah,
what a job that was to move.
Yeah, it was. It was difficult because it happened in the last week, you know, and we risked losing a lot of our people who really supported the Kidney Foundation.
And losing a lot of money. To support,
yeah, exactly. But, you know, everybody was so glad that that decision was made. A lot of the people who came to the luncheon said they would have had a very difficult time crossing the picket line.
Well, talking about moral decisions, among other things here, let's find out what's on your mind. And our first caller is Brett. Morning, Brett.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for calling taking my call. I just had a question for Amy about in your research. I've always had this issue or question about how Buddhists and their mind, they say they don't eat meat and they cannot do the killing of animals. And yet when we look at Native American cultures, they see that everything, plant life, animal life, they all have spirits, and therefore killing one over the other isn't necessarily more wrong. And I was wondering if there's congruency in the Buddhist belief, if they believe that everything has a spirit, and therefore if this whole notion of having to not kill animals is a bit of a hypocrisy, or do they hold animals in a higher regard?
Well, I think as in any religion, any culture, you have variations on what you believe about that particular religion. And yes, there are Buddhists who believe that everything has a spirit. You can't step on an insect, but the Buddhism that I've encountered over the years seemed to have a lot to do with this notion of intentions. I had somebody from a Tibetan Buddhist say to me, when I invited him to dinner, I said, oh, and we're going to order all vegetarian dishes. You know, you'll have plenty to eat. I was a vegetarian anyway, but he said, no, you know, you don't have to do that. I can eat anything. And I said, no, we'll have vegetarian dishes. And then he stopped me and he said, listen, there's a difference between Tibetan Buddhism and Zen Buddhism of Japan. The people in Japan, Zen Buddhists like to eat things that look like meat and pretend that it is. We eat meat and pretend that it isn't or imagine that it isn't. So whether you would call that hypocrisy or, you know, both ways. That you're eating something that's not meat, and yet you want to make it look like meat, you know? So there are so many variations. I wouldn't take my beliefs and then cast it upon them and say, well, they're right or wrong.
Oh, no, I wouldn't do that, no.
Yeah, there's no consistency, though, I think, individual to individual, and certainly then not culture to culture.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call, Brett. And we go to another caller, Ellen. Hi.
Hi. Amy, I was happy to see that you had mentioned the Karen and that you had a Karen character in your books, My Children, a Half Karen. And as you know, I'm sure it's a human rights struggle that the Karen people have been really struggling for 50 years for basic human rights in Burma.
Yeah.
My concern was that using your Karen character as the kidnappers was, I felt a bit unfortunate. I haven't read the book, but I do have concerns about how the way you're casting the Karen. This is a group of people that are, you know, really struggling for rights to survive in Burma, and whether you in fact deal with any of the other continual human rights abuses that are happening to the Karen, both in Burma and in the refugee camps in Thailand.
Yes. The latter, yes. Let me address this thing about kidnapping. They do not kidnap these people, and for some reason, I find it actually really interesting that the way it's been portrayed almost universally is that they do kidnap them. In this story, the intention of the people is to invite them to visit their camp up in the mountains. You know, and there's obviously a little cultural disconnect here. Mm-hmm. They have nothing better. You know, their other thing was canceled. They did arrange for their tour leader to be waylaid, but they just really want them to see it. They do make it, you know, some obstacles there so that it's not easy to get out. But these people never have a sense that they're being held against their will, that there is necessity out there that keeps the, or certain situations, you know, the bridge is down. And they come to realize these people are in dire straits. I did struggle with that notion of not making it seem as though the Karen had these evil intentions of kidnapping people for simply that intention, but I.
Well, that's the way it's been characterized.
Exactly, yeah. It's been characterized, but no, they're in fact, the way they look at it is, you know, that these people were happy to come along and see how they live and what's wrong there, and that they also mistake one of the young boy there as being the younger white brother. Their belief in doing this was based on this necessity and also this belief. So I'm glad you bring that up because, no, it was not meant that to imply that they had kidnapped. Now, the other thing is that I hope that people get the sense that this situation of the Karen is ongoing, that people are being raped and tortured and killed if they object to the government and also those associated with them who have done no such thing. Many of the Karen are not, actively protesting the government through, you know, being part of the, say, Karen Red Army. That's a very small fraction of it. And yet they're also being persecuted.
Right.
The Karen have been fleeing to refugee camps in Thailand. And unfortunately, Thailand has now agreed with Myanmar in sending back people they designate as not having left the country under refugee circumstances, meaning they were not being persecuted, and so they are handed over to the authorities on the Myanmar side. Now, we all know that those people, if they left and they're handed back, they're going to not be treated with welcoming open arms.
Right.
And so it's a very serious situation when, you know, you consider how is it that this has happened, that Thailand would agree to doing something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, no, it's a very complex situation when you look at it. When you also look at the influences of other Southeast Asian countries in that area and what kind of role they can play in trying to change things going on there or how they are actually not helping to change things.
Well, I hope this is an opportunity for the world to learn a little bit more about the Karen. There's a wonderful film out now called Don't Fence Me In by Ruth Gumnit, and it's a half-hour documentary about the Karen people, and it might be of interest to you, but also as you promote your work, I just hope that you can also just keep people's eyes focused on what's happening in that part of the world or the Karen people.
That was the absolute intention. Other than the personal, that was the absolute intention.
But you have to wrap it in a good story, and you've done that. I mean,
yeah.
You know, people...
to make them read it.
Exactly.
You know, because a lot of people don't want to read about the Karen because it's just so horrific and unhappy, and they're helpless to help.
Alan, thank you so much for your
call.
Okay,
thank you, Amy.
We're talking to Amy Tan. Again, her new book is Saving Fish from Drowning, and you're welcome to join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. I was reading... a couple of the reviews, one of them, most of them were really very good and strong, but one of them was saying that the Washington Post guy was kind of taking you to task for being too scatological and and too many sexual jokes and everything. I don't know, maybe they don't expect you to be more prim or something.
You know, I don't read my reviews, but I expected some people to say, wait a minute, you know, you shouldn't throw that stuff in, you know, you should be a little more serious in a satire and all that. And I sort of knew when I was doing this they were going to object to scatological humor. I was being very playful in trying to think, what are all the reasons why people read books to be entertained? And I wanted to kind of play with that notion because I needed to get these people to the jungle where the Karen, you know, were very unhappy people being there, and for us to be lured along there and unable to leave because we want to know what happens. So at the outset, there's a murder mystery when Bibi dies. There is adventure travel. You know, they're going to go someplace and see some things. Travel log, where you get to hear a little bit about the art.
And as, the characters.
And the scatological. You know, we read things. Some people read things because it's just this gross kind of humor, you know. Yeah, you know, all romance, the kind of Midsummer Night's Dream, romantic comedy of errors where they don't get to consummate it until the end, you know, typical romantic comedy. So, you know, I was just playing with that. But, you know, some people, you know, take certain things a little more seriously, I guess, the form itself, as opposed to, I think they maybe didn't see the objective I have. And that's a personal one, and people can react differently to books, and that's valid, you know. Book
and
is
they do.
Different in the hands of each reader.
It's a Rorschach often. Were you thinking about Chaucer, though?
Yeah, I was. I've always liked the Canterbury Tales, and I wanted, you know, the number 12, 12 travelers. Harry Bailey in the Canterbury Tales is the innkeeper. They all go to and they start to tell their stories, and he loves it so much he goes along with them. In this story, Harry Bailey, spelled the same way, is the sort of inebriated traveler who ends up being left behind. And he also narrates part of the journeys of these 12 people and interpret what's happening to them.
As I said, we've also got some really lively and interesting characters. I like the dog trainer and some of the younger people. And we've got kind of a multicultural group as well. Tom, you're on. Hi.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I'm from Burma as well. My original birth name is actually Tun Lin. And when Amy Tan was speaking of saving fish from drowning and pretending and it's not me, kind of triggering my memory, that a lot of the cooks that prepare meals for Burmese families in Burma, they hire Chinese cooks so that you wouldn't personally have to kill the food. But, you know, so it made me think about the difference between hypocrisy and turning the other cheek. In other words, sort of a negligence or neglect. You know, I kind of feel that hypocrisy is when you're on a crusade to fight terrorism, yet you're dropping 500-pound Moab bombs. But I think negligence is a little different. It's sort of turning the other cheek. I say that because I actually, after having been here over two decades in the U.S., I asked one of the participants of the Burmese Democracy Movement who had a forum in Berkeley, St. Joseph the Workers Church, that, you know, what are we doing about the ethnic minorities in Burma, specifically me being of Chinese ancestry, as you are, Amy, and I think that's why it's important that, looking the way you do, went to Burma and you could ask certain questions and may get a particular kind of answer. What I asked was, what about the ethnic minorities? How strong is that issue, that agenda, the rights of ethnic minorities in this current democracy movement?
Yeah.
And I kind of felt that the answer was kind of passed over, put on the back burner, as if it's not, I wouldn't call it hypocrisy, but I called it turning the other cheek.
Yeah. Well, I could not deal with all the other issues of the minorities, but it is mentioned in the book that, for one thing, Burma has had discord among the minority tribes for a very, very long time, with the Burmans being the majority and dominant class. And there, you know, that the kind of persecution extends to many different minorities. The Karen just seems to be a little bit more well-known among some people because of the Red Army and the kind of insurgents, the insurgents who are in the jungle. And there also was a case of two twin boys who had been designated or believed to be deities by the Karens who were up in the jungle and who was leading them. So I was a little bit inspired by this notion of what we believe and what we need to believe in order to protect us and defend us and fight for what we believe. Now, the saving fish from drowning could apply to many things, and our notion of hypocrisy really depends on what we believe. So the government of the military regime of Myanmar also thinks that we need to put down insurgents so that we can have a harmonious country. We look at that and say, well, that's hypocrisy. You know, they're killing people. How can you possibly have harmony when that occurs? And, you know, certain people might look at other kinds of interventions of countries, between countries, within countries, and say, no, you should not do this to people in order to reach this larger future objective, which may or may not be desirable.
Let me thank you, Tom, for the call. And let me go to some emails here. Steve says, please keep in mind that the name Burma was imposed on the people of that region by an oppressive external military regime, the British Empire. Although Myanmar is a name created by another military regime, it at least comes from within. And by the way, my understanding of the pronunciation of the name Myanmar is that it is closest to Myanmar, no accents. The R at the end of the English transliteration, an artifact of a British accent that uses a final R simply to extend the final vowel sound. Having spent a considerable amount of time in northern Thailand, I faced the choice of whether to enter Myanmar, but decided to follow the request of Aung San Suu Kyi and did not enter and give my dollars to support the military regime.
Okay. Right. You know, that is the issue. If you go there, the idea is you're going to support the military. Now, some of the people within Burma, the people, those people who live under this condition say, please come. We are an impoverished country. We've sunk to even greater poverty levels. We need those dollars. And when people are there, the government treats us better. So, there are arguments all over the place. It's a very tricky thing to look at. And I know of people who choose not to go there because they feel then they are in a moral collusion with the government, that those monies also go to the government of the military regime there. A note on the word Myanmar and Burma, some people, Burma also comes from the word Bama, which are how also the Burmans refer to themselves. And you go back and there's been arguments over the centuries as to which name is the one that originally started. Whether, you could say that the colonialists back in the 1800s were the ones who imposed this name, Burma, on the country. Some people go back even farther and say, no, it was Bama back further, and that Myanmar, the Myanmar government, of course, says Myanmar was the original name. Some people say Myanmar and Bama are the variations of the same thing.
Another email here that takes us a little bit off to another subject, but this is from Phil, who says, I saw a performance of Miss Tan's story, Immortal Heart, at the 142 Throckmorton Theater in Mill Valley. It was a stunning verbatim performance by San Francisco's word-for-word performing arts company that was visually and orally engaging and mesmerizing. My question for Miss Tan is, do you feel that your writing is analogous to folk stories, a form that lends itself to being heard aloud as much as being read by the eye?
Well, I'm flattered that you would think they're folk stories because I really love the oral tradition of storytelling. You know, that's what it originated with. And there's something that you have to do with oral storytelling that I think is true in many cultures, and that is you have a reason for telling the story and who your audience is, and you have to convey a sense of honesty and a rhythm in telling the story. I was just in a country, I was in China, but a very remote province among tribes that do not have a written language. And so all of it is conveyed in the form of stories, their history, their customs, and oftentimes in the form of a story that is sung. They have a singing culture there. So I'm always interested in storytelling, and I'm glad if people think that I have, a folk culture form in the way I tell my stories.
You said that you, to some extent, had your mother's voice in mind, Daisy, your mother,
yes,
for Bibi Chen.
Right. My mother also had a storytelling voice.
I was going to ask if she was a storyteller.
Yeah. When she would talk about the past, and especially what happened to her when she was in an abusive marriage, she would actually leap up and enact the very scene that she was talking about as though it was right in front of her. And I found that so fascinating. I realized that throughout childhood, this is exactly what she did, and that perhaps it really did influence the way that I tell stories. Now, my mother had a very digressive technique, too, in which she'd start to say something and then go off, hundreds of miles away from her original point. And sometimes I do that, much to my detriment.
Love that story about your mother saying to you when you're working hard and zealously on your writing, Amy, your head's going to explode.
Yeah. No, squeeze all her brains out.
Yeah.
These horrible images, you know.
Speaking about her being in an abusive relationship, wasn't Kitchen God's Wife going to be made into a film, or is it being made into a film still?
You know, we went through all the hassles of getting the lawyers to work through the contracts, and the studio green-lighted it. You know, when we had asked for the impossible, which we got that with Joyla Club, and that was to have total creative control, which you almost never get. And finally, you know, and part of me was saying it'll never happen. Sure, you know, they want us to do it. Never happen. Well, all the things happened. They said creative control, lawyers approved it, we've got a deal, go. Well, at that point, I was kind of exhausted, and I wanted to go back to writing fiction. It meant that I had devoted something like 3 years to making of the movie, and so if I began another movie, it'd be another 3 years of working on the movie, and I wouldn't write fiction anymore. And I had to remind myself, what is it that I really intend to do with my life? And I decided it was fiction, and I felt horrible, and a lot of people were angry at me for me saying in the end, you know, I don't want to make this movie. I was happy to turn it over to somebody else and say, you make this movie, hire another screenwriter. There's tons of great screenwriters out there, you know, or I can consult on the sides and just certain parts of it. No, it was that or nothing. And so that was, you know, that was the dilemma there.
Excuse me.
So
it's not going to be made.
You know, somebody has just come up and said they want to make a miniseries for TV. And I said, okay, can I just be on the outside as occasional consultant and you have somebody else writing this and working on this? They said yes. So if they work it through, if they get the money, if they get the, you know, go to the lawyers' offices and they all say fine and dandy, then so that might happen. Yeah.
Talk about your mother in terms of Bibi, but the love that she has for art in many ways is like you have. Isn't it?
I do. I have an amateur's love of art and music, and I often think of myself as a failed piano student. You know, I failed my parents' expectations. I wanted to be an artist when I was a child. I didn't want to be a writer. I didn't want to be a musician. I wanted to be an artist. I didn't want to be a doctor, which is what my parents wanted me to do. I loved art. I loved to go to the museum, and I loved to imagine what the art was based on, who did it, what they were feeling at the time, the subjects, especially if they were people, what they were thinking. I had a very personal relationship with art.
And still do.
I still do. I love to, you know, I went on art expeditions. I go to study art. I like to go almost in a sort of quasi-amateur anthropological art and music point of view when I go to places. You know, I can stay in places with kind of less uncomfortable conditions from what we like on vacations, just for that reason of being immersed in something different art.
So you did this in Burma when you were there. I mean, immerse yourself in the art. Yeah.
I did that in Burma. On the art side, it was to follow the influence of art through many different places, the influence of Chinese art and also cultural notions like animism. You know, did it in fact flow somewhat from China, or was it always everything is related at some point, you know, through migration. Where did Buddhism come from in Burma? Was it the Indian side, or was it the Chinese side? You know, because the Buddhism they have some rather pointed differences. And so that was very interesting. I like to have a particular focus when I go to a country and not simply see, you know, the sites, but to go there and say, I want to look at, you know, I could say, I want to look at costumes, I want to look at textiles, or I want to look at art, I want to look at music. I love that kind of focus, because that's the same thing I apply to writing the fiction. I have to have a focus. And then everything that's out there goes through this focus as a filter, and some of it becomes very relevant then and interesting as a result of that focus. It's not diffuse anymore.
But it comes into focus with the focus, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it becomes more meaningful with that.
And you must have spent a lot of time in the Asian Art Museum here in San Francisco. I mean, this is where you place
in many museums, Asian Art Museum here, Asian Art Museums in other places. I was in Omaha just a few days ago, went to the Asian Art Museum there. And you know, they have different emphases in different Asian Art Museums.
When you go to places like Omaha, do people still talk to you like you're from China? And I mean, you've had that experience a few times, I know, in the Midwest.
About 20 years ago, yeah. You know, they were like that. But no, I find by and large that things have changed. Omaha is a very sophisticated city. I was very surprised. They have a gorgeous performing arts center there and Paul McCartney was going to play there the next day. Amazing museum. And they put on a wonderful event for a charity called Child Saving, and I was so pleased to be a part of that because I used to work with young children who had developmental disabilities. So older children there, these orphans who have no homes, often have some sort of disability. And also working with inner city kids. So these are also children at Child Saving who often come from at-risk environments.
And you're still with the Remainders? I mean, still doing on-the-road stuff? And
Yeah, you know, this terrible, perverse indulgence that we older writers still continue to do. But I will say
I should mention for listeners who don't know, it's a rock and roll band.
Rock and roll band of author writers, Stephen King, yeah. Dave Barry, Kathy Kamen Goldmark, our own San Francisco literary star who started the band. Ridley Pearson, Mitch Albom, you know, Greg Isles, Scott Turow wears a wig and sings Talking Heads.
Beyond Forum week from Wednesday, I think, or at least a week from Monday, maybe. I'm sorry. Yeah. And
but we've raised
you can see
a
Amy Tan in
half.
Leather wearing. Actually,
yeah. No, but for that, you know, I do it for a good cause. You know, I wear the dominatrix outfit and, you know, the cat of nine tails. We raised $1.5 million for inner city kids literacy program.
I think it's wonderful. And as long as you keep Lou from breaking bones, you'll be always good to see you and glad to have you on.
Thank you.
Again, Amy will be appearing at Book Passage in Corte Madera tonight at 7 o'clock at the Asian Art Museum on November 3rd with a reception and program talking with Dr. William Wu and National Kidney Foundation Authors Luncheon, a major event, November 5th. Again, let me invite you to inquire about that at 543-3303. There are, I'm told, tickets left. It's at the Marriott, 415-543-3303. Want to thank also our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Malm, Kevin Guillory, and Ariana Picari. Thank our engineer, Danny Bringer. And thanks to all of you. I do appreciate and want you to know we appreciate your listenership, not just rhetoric. We really like having you here, and I hope you'll be with us on tomorrow. Here through Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, and an hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. And our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.